first, I would like to express my heartfelt gratitude to Professor Lochner and the EKGF. Thanks for giving me the wonderful opportunity to do this research here in Erlangen. And I would also like to thank all the research fellows and all the staff in the EKGF for the inspiring and intellectual environment in EKGF. Now, to this topic, determining fate in Chinese art during the Ming and early Qing. The fundamental belief of Chinese religion is the concept of a supernatural or cosmic retribution, that some force, either a supernatural force such as heaven or the gods, or an automatic cosmic reaction, inevitably recompenses human behavior in a rational manner. It rewards certain good deeds, be they religious sacrifices, acts of good government, or upright personal conduct, and punishes evil ones. From emperor to peasant, one earns a good fate for doing good deeds, a bad fate for committing evil deeds. This view of moral retribution dominates the whole Chinese history. Behind this fundamental belief is the view that one can determine, influence, or even change fate. There were many strategies of how to influence fate. The idea of the auspicious signs, or more precisely, the idea of creating auspicious wishes, is one of many strategies. It became popular in the Yule reign in the Ming and thereafter. Today's talk explores this popularization and how it was represented in Chinese art, especially in Chinese literary painting. Here's the outline of today's talk. I will start with Zhu Di, the third emperor of Ming Dynasty. In the second part, I will focus on the popularization and show a series of images. If the first two parts are concerned with determining fate for the living, then the third part discusses very briefly determining fate for the dead or dying. This section will conclude with a final example, an album leaf by Shi Tao in 1707. In the first part, I will give some explanations for the popularization. Now I'll start with the first point. Confucian ideology defined the emperor as the pivotal figure in a cosmological system that connected heaven and earth. The ideal son of heaven was a ruler who followed the heavenly principle, Tianli, so that he could order the world. One standard way by which Chinese rulers legitimized their right to rule was by the official recognition and promotion of certain unusual phenomena as auspicious responses manifesting heaven's approval of the reigning emperor. From the Han to Song dynasty, auspicious responses, Rui Ying, or auspicious signs, Xiang Rui, were important confirmations of the right to rule for emperors. One of the earliest sources of auspicious signs can be found in the book of history, Shi Ji, Feng Shan Shu, in a story about the king of Qi, Qi Huan Gong, who died in 643 BC. Today I'm not going to talk about the early auspicious omens. We have an expert, Lilian, here. If you have any questions, just read her second chapter of her great book, Picturing Heaven in Early China. Compared with the Han Chinese emperorship, the Mongols in the Yuan period did not show much interest in using the idea of auspicious signs in the emperorship. This situation changed completely, however, during the Ming dynasty. The turning point was the third Ming emperor, Zhu Di. Zhu Di, the emperor Yongle, was the fourth of 29 sons, not counting the 18 daughters of Zhu Yuanzhang, who founded the Ming dynasty in 1368. Zhu Di usurped the throne from his nephew, the emperor Jianwen, after 3 years of intense civil war. he did not possess the legitimacy of a designated heir among the sons of the founder of the Ming Dynasty, since the Emperor Jianwen was never captured. This uncertainty would cast a pall over the entire Yongle reign, as the nephew might appear at any time and seek to reclaim his throne. The idea of Xiang Rui, auspicious signs, or Rui Ying, auspicious responses, was one of many political strategies the Emperor Yongle had used. This hand scroll, Ming Lei Fu Zhou Yu Tu, was produced to commemorate the appearance of the auspicious animal Zhou Yu. On the 8th day of the 9th month of the 2nd Ringing year of Yongle, it was 1404, his brother Prince Su of Zhou brought the emperor an auspicious white animal called Zhou Yu as a present. Since the early Han Dynasty, Zhou Yu had been interpreted as a wondrous human creature. On this hand scroll, the Zhou Yu looks like a white tiger, with dark stripes and fine Kuvin linear patterns above his eyes. 27 high officials submitted 27 eulogies, biao, to congratulate the emperor on the appearance of the Zhou Yu. Most of the high officials were rewarded for getting a higher position. Only a few of them are unknown due to unavailable historical sources. These eulogies were later added as colophons to this hand scroll. It's not all the colophons, still not all of them here. There were at least two different versions of the Zhou Yu Tu. One of them was hung at the Wenhua Hall in the palace. Besides these Zhou Yu paintings, there were some other paintings representing auspicious responses in the Yongle reign. For reasons of time, I won't show these paintings. The Emperor Yongle strategically directed material manifestations of his legitimacy by means of these auspicious paintings. He summoned his clansmen, especially the other princes and officials, to witness his legitimacy when auspicious omens revealed the agreement from heaven. And it's in and after the Yongle reign, however, that the concept of auspicious signs became popular. Now I come to the second part of my talk. First, let me quote a passage by Maggie Bickford. The mass-produced paintings of phoenixes, dragons, peonies, and godfish that seem to hang in every Chinese restaurant, double happiness paper cards pasted on the walls of wedding banquet halls, long-life medallions that decorate carpets, locks and cocktail napkins, bats at the bottom of soup bowls, plastic plum blossoms, the color red. These multitudinous images are in fact survivors, emulations and adaptations of something far bigger, the overwhelming presence of auspicious graphic devices in the visual daily life of traditional China. Auspicious images constitute the longest and the most comprehensive visual tradition in the history of Chinese art and culture. There are two important points in this passage. The first one reveals the popularization of auspicious responses, and the second point concerns the auspicious wish images, which derive from the auspicious responses. There are two categories of auspicious images. One refers to auspicious response images, and the other refers to auspicious wish images. Auspicious response images are represented to record or eulogize auspicious phenomena, while auspicious wish images that function like or good wishes cards are made to wish somebody good luck. Zhou Yu Tu, for example, is an auspicious response painting, which was used to record the appearance of the auspicious animal Zhou Yu. Different from auspicious response images, auspicious wish images also include devices that help to avert harm are images designed to embody good outcomes. These good outcomes included imperial legitimacy, examination honors, bureaucratic advancement, longevity, health, and wealth. In fact, such auspicious wish images can also be found in previous periods. It was only in the Ming, however, that the idea of making auspicious signs became popular within and outside of the court. Indeed, it continued in the Qing period and down to our own day. Now I show you a series of dragon images. A dragon embodies the forces of nature, bring rain which is needed for harvest year. The symbolic meaning of dynamism in nature was first adapted from Taoism. Before the Ming, we can find dragons with 3, 4, 5 claws. Sometimes they symbolized imperial power, sometimes not. This ways, with a 5-clawed dragon from the 12th century in the Northern Song period was used outside the court. It came from Cizhou in Hebei province, where March stoneware was produced for a middle-class market. It was only after the Yongle reign, however, that the symbolic meaning for imperial power of a 5-clawed dragon was established and reinforced. Now, the Yongle emperor again. He faces slightly to the viewer's right. He wears a simple yellow robe decorated with a few 5-clawed dragon medallions. The setting of a chair and a carpet against an unpainted background is minimal. He was portrayed in a naturalistic pose that emphasized three-dimensionality. About 60 years later, here we see the Emperor Hongzhi. He's centered within a monumental composition, seated on a richly decorated throne and framed by a screen of elaborately painted 5-clawed dragons. 6 5-clawed dragon medallions are visible on the skirt of his robe. By contrast, he's depicted in the striking pose of rigid frontality. Nearly every succeeding emperor through the end of the dynasty is portrayed in this arresting manner. We can see here that the image of the 5-clawed dragon symbolizing imperial power had become more important. And the next dragon is from, this dragon is now in the British Museum. In the center is a panel enclosing 2 5-clawed dragons with a flaming pair here and some peony scrolls. And there are 4 phoenixes among the flowers of 4 seasons. And next, this detail shows that 1 claw on each foot here of the dragons has been removed. Here was one, and here another one. And it was possibly produced first for the imperial court, but was later used outside the court, for example, by a high official. And the next 2 dragons are woodblock print. The left one is from the book The Ink Garden of the Cheng Family, and the right one was published in the book First Collection of Designs for Stationery of Shi Zhu Studio. These 2 paintings indicate that images of 3 or 4-clawed dragons were used as designs either for inkstones, the left one, or for stationery, the red one, in ordinary household. Now I come to the key issue of today's talk, the popularization of auspicious signs in Chinese literary painting. For the first time in the history of Chinese painting, Many literati paintings with auspicious motifs were produced in the Ming and early Qing periods. Shen Zhou was one of the earliest literati painters to do so. There's a considerable amount of research on auspicious court paintings in the scholarship, but auspicious literati paintings and the popularization of the auspicious in literati paintings in the Ming and early Qing periods have not yet been discussed. In general, Chinese literati painting is considered as being independent from court and artisan styles and ideologies, emphasizing amateurism and the role of inscriptions or colophons instead. According to Chinese literati painting theory, the literatus painted as he wrote, putting forward his own views and feelings, while the artisan or the court painter, with an eye to his patron's wishes, obviously could not. During the Yuan period, the movement of personalized painting, the most important feature of Chinese literati painting, appeared, in which the Chinese literati found the expressive quality of painting in representing personal experience. However, the word literati in connection with literati painting actually became controversial in and after the 15th century. Literati painting became commercialized during this period. The city of Suzhou, called Wuxian or Wujun in the Ming period, and its surrounding area became the richest part of China. Not only did the number of patrons increase, but also the class of literati artists, who were educated but often without government appointment, grew larger with its steadily improving position in society. This is Shen Zhou's Zhi Tian Tu. Shen Zhou was born not far from today's Suzhou. Being a highly educated amateur artist, Shen Zhou never embarked upon an official career. This painting was a gift painting. A human figure is sitting on a mat in a room with the door opened. To the left of the two houses, a field with lots of fungus is depicted. And that's the second section of this hand scroll, and then the end section. The first two lines of Shen Zhou's inscription read, "The family Dong planted apricots to repay the virtue. Heaven repaid your family with an entire field filled with fungus." It's important to note the word bao. Craig Clunas discussed bao in terms of gift exchange. It can also be understood as a heavenly response to a human deed. Shen Zhou addresses here that it's the heaven's response for the vulture the patron had. This painting is one of few literary paintings dealing with auspicious responses. The next painting, Li Shi Tu, by Shen Zhou, concerns auspicious wish images. It's a New Year's present for a certain Su Tian, who must be a businessman. It functions as a rebus, since the word Li Shi, Li Qi and Pessimon, has the same pronunciation as another word Li Shi, literally benefit in the market. Shen Zhou wishes for his friend to receive benefits in his business. The Chinese rebus often occurs as a pun on one or more words. Since the language creates many homophonic words, each represented by a different character, its use in literature can be safely traced back to Yuefu poetry of the Han period. The next painting, Gu Bai Tu, Old Cypress, was depicted by Wen Zhengming in 1550. It was a gift to a young man named Zhang Fengyi, who at that point lay ill in a Buddhist monastery outside the city of Suzhou, Wen Zhengming's home. Wen's inscription urges, and that's the colophons, And that's the poem written by Wen Zhengming. Wen Zhengming's inscription urges on the young man the fortitude of the old cypress, and maybe also by extension the 80-year-old Wen Zhengming. It can be understood as an auspicious wishes painting, as Wen Zhengming wished for the young man to recover from his illness and live a long life like the old cypress. In other words, Wen attempted to influence the young man's fate. Now I come to the third part of today's talk. In this section, I will show very briefly a hand scroll by Wu Li and an album leaf by Shi Tao. Both Wu Li's hand scroll and Shi Tao's album leaf attempt to create a good afterlife for the dead or the dying. To some extent, they can also be seen as auspicious wish paintings, which bring good wishes to the dead or dying for them to have good luck in their afterlives. This is Wu Li's Remembering the Past at Xingfu Chapel. Wu Li became a Christian a year before he painted this hand scroll. This hand scroll clearly has three well-defined parts in a composition of juxtaposition. The Xingfu Chapel part on the right side of the painting, which is the beginning of the hand scroll, and then the mountain part at the center, and then the clouds part on the left. In the Xingfu Chapel, an empty chamber with an open door is depicted. Inside the chamber is a small table with a scroll lying on it. In front of the table is a mat. The depiction of the absent person alludes to the death of Wu Li's friend, the Chan Buddhist monk Mo Rong. At the same time, it hints at the rebirth in the Pure Land Paradise. This is the north wall of cave 172 at Mo Gaoku. The north wall of this cave deals with the scene of the Pure Land Paradise. Now, in the upper right corner, we see that we can focus now here. This part is another depiction of the Amida Buddha with his two bodhisattvas. Here, with their backs towards the viewer, which represents Amida living for his return to paradise. It represents the moment in which the deceased is taken away by Amida on the way back to paradise. The empty room depicted below suggests that the deceased has left for paradise. Except for the Dunhuang mural paintings, there were hardly any available Chinese Pure Land paintings from the 16th to 16th century revealing the concept of absence. However, it's well known that the belief in Amida was embraced by Chinese people at all levels of society in the Ming and Qing periods. And it's quite likely that the concept of absence revealing rebirth in the Pure Land existed in Pure Land Buddhist art in 16th and 17th century China. Oh, sorry. No, it comes. Where were?
I'm sorry.
Okay, next. The mountain part. The mountains are depicted in heavy blue and green manner in the middle part of the Xingfu scroll. Heavy blue and green landscape paintings symbolize normally immortality or paradise. Such paintings with depiction of clouds can be often seen as paradise paintings, like this one by Qiu Ying. And this painting hints at the Taoist paradise. And now, for reasons of time, I just show the next, the symbolic meaning of the old leafless trees is related to the rebirth in paradise. It can be seen in this Shi Tao's last section of his painting, Sketches of Calligraphy and Painting by Qin Xiang. The idea of rebirth in Shi Tao's painting is represented by an old Buddhist Luohan-looking man sitting in the old leafless tree. The inscription begins as follows. An old tree in the empty mountain has sat there for 40 kapha. It ends with an rhetorical question. The man in the picture, could we call him the blind abbot's future incarnation or not? The blind abbot, Xia Zunzhe, originally the name of a Buddhist Luohan, was Shi Tao's literary name Hao before 1697. In 1697, Shi Tao gave up his Buddhist identification and took on a new literary name with Taoist implications. This painting of Shi Tao seems to be a pseudo self-portrait of the final identity of a Buddhist monk who waits for a future incarnation. Now the last part, the clouds, the section of clouds. In his undated poem, Commendation of St. Yusuf, Wu Li described his dream in a paradise. For him, the paradise is the place where the blue mountains met the white clouds in the east. That's the last line of his poem. Indeed, Wu Li created a Pure Land paradise or a rebirth in the Pure Land by depicting the empty chamber, the old leafless trees, the mountains in a heavy blue and green manner along with white clouds for his deceased friend Mo Rong. Now the next painting is the tenth leaf riding the clouds by Shi Tao. This album leaf represents a human figure on the left side at the foot of the album leaf. Here, there's the human figure. Wandering on a fungus lingzhi-shaped road of clouds. It's a journey towards the afterlife on a road of clouds which has taken the form of the lingzhi fungus in the sky. This album leaf hints at death's drawing nearer and at the wish for an afterlife journey towards paradise or immortality. Shi Tao died a couple of months after having completed this album. This leaf functions as a foreshadowing of approaching death and a version of the afterlife journey in the netherworld. The belief in a soul journey in the afterlife was widely embraced in the Ming and the Qing periods. Evidence showing the soul journey in the form of lingzhi fungus going to paradise can be found in Buddhist art. This lotus seed depicted on the southern wall of cave 217 in Dunhuang in the 8th century hints at the idea that the figure on it is on a trip to the Pure Land. You see that there's human figure sitting on the lotus seat. That's the dead body. And the winding line left by the figure looks like clouds in the form of fungus. This, the next one, that's a detail of this human figure. This is the nice illustration to the scripture on the ten kings. The two deceased, a man and a woman, are riding on the clouds in the form of fungus to paradise, while another official-looking man is in front of the door of to hell. Now I come to the last part of my talk. The explanations for the popularization of making auspicious signs are very complex. The first factor I would mention is the princely court system in the Ming, which acting as a transitional factor spread imperial taste quickly outside the court and vice versa. Ming princes of various ranks resided in nearly 100 cities. The princely establishments in the provinces meant that the greater court extended throughout much of the empire. Material goods, ritual, political personnel, and social markers tied together this extended court system. Princely courts often acted as important sources of cultural patronage. Perhaps that's the most significant, or at least most widely disseminated of Qinli projects was the series Pictures of the Treatise of the Sage, Shengji Tu, Scenes of the Life of Confucius, which occupied the attention of two separate lineages of the imperial clan in the 16th century, according to Yulia Murray and Craig Clunas. That's the scene that the auspicious omens of two dragons and five old men symbolizing five stars appeared in heaven when Confucius was born. And in these illustrated books, images concerning auspicious responses or auspicious wishes were of importance. Since we talked about Confucius, I just added this slide. That's the newborn baby, which is Confucius, with characters written on his stomach. And you see the heavenly music, heavenly omen music. And next one? That's the standard picture of Confucius, or of this wood block printing. And another important factor is the economic development in the Ming, which I mentioned before. According to Timothy Brook, the imperial household also bought from workshops outside the capitals in places where artisanal specialties were well developed, from Suzhou Kim silks, from Hangzhou embroideries, from Jiangxi paper and porcelains. Court demand stimulated these industries and promoted styles that non-imperial workshops very quickly imitated styles from imperial workshops to meet the growing demand of the status-conscious rich. Goods that sold well were readily imitated. The finest carved red lacquer at the beginning of the Ming came from Dali Prefecture's Yunnan, but it was imitated by other producers so successfully that their wares sold well on the Nanjing market, according to Timothy Brook. The following description by He Liangjun provides us a detail of the using of household objects with auspicious motifs in a rich family in Jiaxing in the late Ming. He Liangjun criticized, in fact, the bad taste of this rich family. He wrote, "The household used silver breezers and golden spittoons. Every guest had a set of golden dish and dish stand, and a great golden cup with a pair of dragons. Each set contained about 15 or 16 ounces. I passed the night there, and the next morning washed my face in a silver basin chased with plum blossom. The hangings, curtains, and bedclothes were all of brocaded gauze, and my sight was assaulted to the point where I could not close my eyes at night." Besides the economic factor, the impact of Neo-Confucianist, Buddhist, and philosophical Taoist thought also played a significant role. This hanging scroll by Shenzhou Night Sitting was painted in 1492. On the hanging scroll, Shenzhou has portrayed himself sitting at the open door of his house with a candle and books on the table beside him. In his long inscription, Shenzhou recorded the experience of attaining a state of quiescence through sitting quietly on a cold autumn night. The practice of quiet sitting, 静坐. Influenced, in fact, by Buddhism and Taoism, is an experience of enlightenment. And self-cultivation is one of the key words in understanding Shen Zhou's Yezuotu night sitting. In the last lines, in the inscription, Shen Zhou expressed the reasons for practicing the quiet sitting as follows. Through this practice, one can pursue the principles that underline events and things and the subtlest workings of one's own mind and body as the basis of self-cultivation and a proper mode of response to external things. In this passage, the term principle li, mind, xin, body, ti, and self-cultivation xiu ji are some of the key words in Neo-Confucianism. In Neo-Confucianism, especially in xinjue, heart learning, the way to apprehend the principle of things such as the meaning of life lies in one's own nature, in one's own mind. For Shen Zhou, quiet sitting is a way of cultivating his mind. After the Middle Ming, that fate is changeable was deepened during the Morality Books movement. It was the Neo-Confucian Yuan Huang who adapted this idea from his Chan monk teacher Yun Gu. Yuan Huang addresses that one can control one's own destiny by striving for virtue, or one can judge the value of one's own actions and thus be assured of an appropriate reward. Literati like Yuan Huang used morality books to teach people to do good and avoid evil, or in other words, as the title of one of his books suggests, to determine one's own fate, Li Ming Pian, which was first published in 1607. The last factor in the popularization is perhaps the development of print culture in the Ming. Although the expansion of printing in the early Ming was slow, there were still books printed in massive numbers required by the first emperor Hong Wu that he wanted people to read. Standard editions of all school textbooks based on editions of the Confucian classics judged to be correct. Administrative handbooks, laws, rites, bureaucratic rules, official dictionaries, and moral primers. A good example is the pictures of the treatises of the sage I mentioned before. In the Middle and Late Ming, whether technological, divinatory, or canonical, books of all sorts were being printed, and in numbers and variety beyond what had been produced at any previous time. Now I come to the conclusion. Today's talk has showed images revealing the idea that one can influence fate in a particular way when auspicious wishes are created. The central idea behind it is the belief in moral retribution. In the Ming and early Qing periods, the concept of the auspicious, especially the concept of creating the auspicious, was not only popularized but also commercialized. The turning point was the Emperor Yongle, who used the auspicious as one of his political strategies. For the first time, Chinese literary paintings of the auspicious were produced in large number, and Shen Zhou was one of the earliest literary painters to do so. The most important reason for the popularization of the auspicious are the extended court system, economic and philosophical factors, and the highly developed print culture in the Ming. Thank you.